26th Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. Today we have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5529, the Oregon Health and Science University. And before we go directly into the invited public testimony, I'm going to turn it over to Legislative Fiscal Office Steve Bender, who's going to provide some overview and information. So, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before we start on Senate Bill 5529, I just wanted to inform the subcommittee of a late change in your schedule for this week. You had been scheduled to have public hearings on the OHSU budget bill this week, but on Wednesday, there will be scheduled for the subcommittee Senate Joint Resolution 3 and Senate Bill 48. SJR 3 repeals the corporate kicker, and Senate Bill 48 implements the repeal statutorily and directs the unanticipated corporate revenues into the education stability funds. So that's being added to your agenda for Wednesday. It's not clear, but there probably would be, we're not taking OHSU actually off the agenda yet at this point, but if there is any time for them, it won't be very much. So most likely, OHSU would have to be extended one more day, which would be one week from today on Monday. And we're working with the agency to see whether to move the public testimony to Monday or keep that on Thursday as was planned. But that is a change, so please be prepared for that. But the bill that you have before you today, Senate Bill 5529, which I think I already referred to as the budget bill for Oregon Health and Science University, more accurately really isn't the budget bill for them. It's more accurately the state support bill for OHSU, because OHSU operates as a public corporation, and unlike the other state agencies for whom you actually approve a budget, for OHSU you're not approving their budget. That's approved by their board of directors, but you are approving state support for them. What I've done is I have prepared a handout that you may want to look at that gives a very brief and high-level overview of some of the major funding issues or history of funding for OHSU, to sort of ground their presentation, which will be starting today and continuing for the rest of this week, and give you some grounding as they discuss their various programs and the economic issues that they face. If you look at the handout here, on the first page, the first slide, indicates historically the state funding for OHSU beginning in 1999-01. And I'll be using that as the starting biennium for all of the budgets that we go through that I'm staffing for you. That, of course, is the last biennium before the last recession hit. So the recession started affecting budgets in 2001-03. So using that as a base, you can see that OHSU received $112 million from the state for what is labeled here as operating grants. These are funds that are distributed directly from the state to OHSU to support a number of its activities, including its educational programs, its hospital and clinical programs, and some public service programs. So in 2009-11, they received $112 million. In the following biennium, as the recession hit, the state reduced that amount to $96 million. So the amount of direct state support was reduced. But if I could skip above the intermediate number, the 5.1, and go to the top of that bar, in yellow, the state provided $93.7 million in bonds for the Oregon Opportunity Program. These were general obligation bonds of $200 million in total. If you add the two yellow bienniums there, you'll see they add to $200 million. But the state transferred the proceeds to OHSU in order to assist them in expanding their bioscience research programs and also some programs in rural areas. These funds were used, and you'll hear more about this from OHSU, but these funds were used for both a combination of capital expenditures to build facilities that support the expansion of the biotech and bioscience research at the university, as well as used to hire faculty and get them started to recruit and get additional faculty in the research area online. Now going back to the part that I skipped over, the amount that's $5.1 million in 2001-03 biennium, this represents the debt service that the state pays on these general obligation funds. So the amount that the state is providing or using, spending to support OHSU is shown in 2001-03, 2003-05, et cetera, as comprising both operating grants and the debt service funds, which actually don't go to OHSU. The state pays these directly, so OHSU doesn't see these funds. But we are using them. We are paying $32 million of biennium now in support of the Oregon Opportunity Program. The operating grants dropped to $73.3 million in the current biennium. The main drop from 2003-05 is that the state eliminated its support for the hospital operations, for the general hospital operations. That was eliminated. And that's most of the drop that you see there between 2003-05 and 2005-07. The governor is recommending a fairly large increase in the operating grants portion of the budget. The debt service is now fixed and will remain at that level throughout the remaining term of the bonds. The bonds were issued for 20 years. But the operating grants have an increase, which we'll talk about later. If you flip ahead to Chart 2 takes the what was in blue in Chart 1, and I shouldn't have done it this way, but that now becomes red in this chart. That's the state support amount. The blue represents other revenues that were, or other expenditures, I should say, for the OHSU university portion of their budget that was supported from non-state revenues and that was not restricted. I'm sorry, that term should be unrestricted in the label there. I did that backwards. Let's just say other OHSU university unrestricted funds. The university also receives funds that are restricted for particular purposes, such as for particular research grants or for student aid or for things of that nature. These are the funds, though, that the university is receiving from a wide range of sources that it combines with the state support in order to support the teaching and academic functions of the institution. So you can see there that looking at the university budget, it's much larger than what the state support was. If you flip to chart 3, OHSU also operates a hospital and has clinics as well. And if you add in, again, the term restricted here in both cases should be unrestricted. Can't believe I did that. But here, if you add in the hospital revenues, this is basically showing the operating budget of OHSU as an institution with its hospital and university combined, not looking at, though, the particular funds that have been restricted to a particular use. And the hospital, as you can see, is larger in budget size than the university portion. Most of the revenue that comes to support the hospital is in the form of fees for services, so fees for treating patients who come to the hospitals and clinics. Chart 4 looks at funding and sees how it has changed over time. If you adjust it for inflation and you normalize it so that the 99-01 biennium level prior to the past recession is 100, if you look at the bottom line there in blue, this is the state support amount. It just doesn't include the Oregon Opportunity Bonds, but it just includes the operating grants and the debt service. You can see that support was cut to a very large extent in the time since the 99-01 biennium. In the current biennium, 05-07, where it's 80.4, basically this means that the amount of funding that the state is providing to OHSU has been reduced by about 20% from the 09-11 level, adjusting for inflation, general inflation. This is the Consumer Price Index. Of course, OHSU, which is heavily involved in providing medical care, has a lot of costs that are increasing more rapidly than the CPI, because medical costs have been increasing more rapidly than costs in general. But the governor's recommended budget would increase funding, but it would still be below the 09-11 level when adjusted for inflation. It would still be about 7.5% below that level. The line in the middle, the black line, shows what the state's general fund and lottery fund revenues have been over this time, again adjusted for inflation. So you can see that in the recession, inflation-adjusted revenues dropped by about 5%. In the current biennium, they've recovered, and we now have approximately the same amount of money adjusted for inflation as we did in 99-01. Of course, this doesn't account for population growth or anything. It's just the amount of money. The governor's recommended budget would increase expenditures to about 15.7% above the 99-01 level if you were to approve that budget. The red line shows the OHSU's unrestricted operations. That's to say, from the prior page, where you see the hospital and the university combined, you can see that although the state support for OHSU declined, their revenues have increased far more rapidly than the state's revenues have. And in the current biennium, they're approximately 30% above the level of prior to the recession, adjusted for inflation. We can't extend that further because we don't have budgets that were approved for 07-09 yet, but this goes historically, including the currently approved budget. Finally, a couple of other quick charts. I don't want to spend much time going over these. Chart number 5 looks at the consolidated net income, or in some sense the bottom line of OHSU's operations. And you can see that in recent years, the university has been able to generate income in excess of its expenditures and depreciation expenses of between $30 and $40 million per year. The current budget shows a decline in what the expectation is, and you'll be hearing some of the reasons for this from the university when they do their presentation, but some of this involves the costs of new facilities that are coming online that aren't yet generating the amount of income that it is hoped they eventually will when they fully phase in usage. And finally, here's a little more detail for you on the governor's recommended budget. This is just looking at the state support. And you can see state support, how it was distributed in 05-07, and how the governor is recommending it be distributed in 07-09. I do regret that some of these numbers in 05-07 are slightly different from the numbers that the university will be presenting. But in general, this will show that those state funds go to support the primary functions or recipients of state funds include the School of Medicine, the Schools of Nursing and Dentistry, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, the Area Health Education Centers and Office of Rural Health, and the Oregon Poison Center. As you can see here, a couple of items, there are a lot of items that don't get any state support, and you could sort of do a pretty long list of them. But I've just listed a couple of these items that are interesting, mainly, that I think are especially interesting. The hospitals and clinics are continued. As I said, state support was eliminated in 05-07, and the governor would continue no funding for the hospitals and clinics. And there is another complete school at OHSU, in addition to medicine, nursing, and dentistry. That's the OGI School of Science and Engineering. And that has never received state support since it merged with OHSU and is continuing not to. But I just put that in there. The governor is increasing medicine, nursing, and AHEC, Office of Rural Health, funding by approximately 40% from the current biennium, with smaller increases for dentistry, CBRC, and the poison center.
Thank you, Steve. I had one question, maybe if others do. When you said that the numbers on the last slide, the numbers for the 0507 legislatively approved budget are different, but OHSU has different numbers?
The distribution of the $73.3 million among the various schools is different. They distributed this based on the second year of the 03-05 biennium. These numbers that I show are based on both years of the 03-05 biennium, so they're somewhat different. But there aren't any major differences.
Okay, thank you very much.
That way.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Steve on that? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, could you clarify again on slide 4, the State General Fund and Watering Fund? This will be the first slide.
The State General Fund and Lottery Fund series that is shown there, that starts at 100 and ends at 115.7, does not represent funding that the state provided to OHSU. In fact, it really has nothing to do with OHSU. That particular line is just your total General Fund and Lottery Fund revenues and expenditures that are available statewide. So this is actually the state budget. The black line shows the growth of the state budget. The blue line shows the growth of, or the change, the decline in state support for OHSU. And the red line shows the amount of funds that OHSU has had available to it over this period of time.
Thank you.
Are there any questions, other questions or clarification?
Mr. Chair. Senator Decker, sorry, that's coming in late. I started looking at slide number 4. Why, dumb question here, why during the 2001-03 recession did not the blue line go down?
It did go down in 2001-03 from 100 to 86.5. Then in 2003-05, it was basically, there was not a further decline in terms of support adjusted for inflation. If you go to the first page here, this gives you a little more detail of the state dollars that were going to OHSU. And you can see when we break this down between 2001-03 and 2003-05, the dark blue, which is the support that we give them for their operations, did decline. It went down from 96 to 85.8. But the lighter blue, which represents the debt service that we're paying on the Oregon Opportunity bonds, increased because they were phasing in. And it's both of those together that we're showing on the chart number 4, as state support, because these are dollars that the state is using to support the programs of OHSU.
Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question. On slide 4, if these were adjusted for inflation and student population, would this curve look appreciably different or approximately the same?
Senator Morse, the numbers, there would be some difference because, as you will hear, OHSU has been expanding enrollments in some of its programs, particularly in nursing. There's been some fairly significant expansions, and even in medicine, there have been some expansions, and there are further expansions that would be anticipated. I'm not sure it would be a huge difference, but it would show a greater decline than it is being shown, than it's being shown here.
Okay. Other questions? Great. Thank you very much. All right, now I have the pleasure of calling up Dr. Joe Robertson, the president of OHSU, and Dr. Leslie Halleck, the provost and vice president for academic affairs. Welcome.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here today to give you the introduction and oversight to our testimony. In giving you the oversight, we will briefly review the mission, but don't panic, we won't read the entire mission statement. There are some parts of it that I think are appropriate to review, and that is that we are the state's only comprehensive academic health center, and we take a certain, we try and shoulder the responsibility that comes with that. Our fundamental purpose is to improve the health and well-being of Oregonians and Oregonian communities. A 10-member board of directors nominated by the governor and confirmed by the Oregon Senate governs the university. And one of the important points that we like to review is besides the various activities that you hear about, I think that an academic health center serves as the moral compass for the bioscience and medical communities. I think all of you are quite familiar and you've heard before about the four prongs of our mission: teaching, discovery, healing, and service. And just to review the last component of that, we try and lead and advocate for programs that improve health for all Oregonians and extend OHSU's education, research, and healthcare missions through community service partnerships and outreach. And that is why, for instance, there's a OHSU presence in all the counties in Oregon, and we consider our campus really all 96,000 miles of the square miles of the state. There are several components to OHSU. There's the health system that you just heard about. It consists of the University Hospital, the Children's Hospital, the CDRC, Center for Women's Health, and other components. We have traditionally listed five schools. In some ways, we actually have six schools. Under many organizational arrangements, there would also be a graduate school. There is no specific funding for a graduate school, so the graduate programs are actually embedded in the other schools, but I think that's noteworthy when considering the total amount of support. We have our research schools, centers, and institutes, all with a specific and directed purpose. Generally, those are extremely efficient and organized in that way. And then we have our community outreach programs in education, research, and healthcare. Examples will include the Office of Rural Health, the Area Health Education Centers, our K-12 pipeline diversity programs, our rural practice network, and many others, including outreach clinics. I think all of you are aware that until 1995, OHSU was a state agency. Some of the drivers that really mandated a change in that structure were managed care and Measure 5. OHSU had to become more efficient and move with greater alacrity and flexibility if it was to remain competitive in the marketplace. So Senate Bill 2 made OHSU a public corporation. It streamlined the governance structure. And besides making us more nimble, it also allowed us to go to the bond market. And I think those were some of the key components that were resulted in the growth that you saw in the previous set of slides. I can assure you that all of this change has been transparent with regard to the day-to-day activities of the faculty. It has not affected the reasons that they are there, and the reasons that the faculty there are there are to engage in that public, public mission and partner with the state to fund the schools and rural health programs and to work in those arenas. It is with great pride that we always show these statistics. I think people have come to expect to see them. But again, I don't want the statistics to hide the fact that the core purpose of OHSU is to improve the health and well-being of Oregonians. I take great pride in that while we are being successful in accomplishing that mission, we can generate the statistics such as you will see. We now exceed 12,000 employees. We're Portland's largest employer, the fourth largest in the state, with a $1.2 billion operating budget. a very large statewide economic impact of $2.7 billion, generating 42,000 jobs, earning $27 for every dollar that the state invests, and returning nearly $37 million to the state in employee income tax and other taxes. Here is another way of demonstrating our growth. If you will look here over the past three decades, you will see a marked growth of an institution despite a declining percentage of state appropriation, and this does include the growth of students in the far right-hand column that you see there, increased by approximately 50%, and that does not include many other student learners. Those are only technically enrolled students, for instance, that does not include the residents and interns, and does not also include the people that are enrolled in continuing medical education programs that number in the thousands at OHSU. Here is our total revenue. We will see that there is not only marked growth, there has been marked growth on both the university and the hospital side. The growth of the university components would have been impossible without the corresponding growth in the health system. Here is a slide that shows the net income from the health system is essential for basically floating the academic boat. If we were not tied to an academic health center, we would not be self-sustaining. The real key to our success during the past few years has been the phenomenal efficiency and performance of the health system over the past several years. It has been able to maintain a 6% margin. That has been absolutely essential to the growth of these programs. Without it, we would not have been able to generate the capital necessary for the new programs, and we would not have been able to maintain the bond rating necessary to generate capital in the bond market. If looking at this slide, you will see how the capital has been allocated. And if you will look over the past 9 years, even though on a year-to-year basis the economic activity is greater in the health system than on the university side, you will see that the capital has been disproportionately spent in support of the academic activities. Our revenue sources are multiple. We try and be creative. We don't just come to the state with hat in hand. We try and seek every source we can to fund our programs. We will see here again the predominance of the patient care sector, although becoming larger, markedly so, over the past several years, as that yellow segment of the pie that includes the gifts, grants, and contracts. OHSU now receives nearly $300 million of grants and awards each year. This is one of many ways of demonstrating the state appropriation. And this does include the bond, the debt coverage, and demonstrates that over the past decade, the total support has gone down, and was previously noted, probably the area of greatest concern to us, and that has been the greatest constraint, has been the reduction in the portion of our operating budget. State funding supports the educational mission, the outreach programs, and the Oregon opportunity, of course, to expand our research and tech transfer missions. Here is a list of our total, the current debt service. You will see that we have been successful over the past few years, despite the expansion, in reducing the total amount of debt that we carry as an institution. We are hopeful that will, in fact, result in a favorable change in our bond rating status, and that is pending, and hopefully we'll hear in the next few months. The university health system is large and complex. The university hospital is the largest hospital in the state. On a given day, there will be more patients hospitalized at OHSU than anywhere else in the state. It is also the hospital with the highest case severity index in the state. That means we have the sickest patients. You will hear about the University Medical Group. that is really nothing more than a way to organize the faculty of OHSU. It actually includes faculty in the School of Medicine and School of Nursing, and organize them into a practice in a manner that helps us facilitate contracting, billing, and actual other regulatory matters as it pertains to Medicare. All members are on the OHSU faculty. We have won more than our fair share of awards. The one that you probably will hear mentioned most frequently is the National Research Corporation Consumer Choice Survey, or NRC. This is administered every year. It used to be done through a mail survey. Now it's done online. And we have won this award 7 years running. This is the third year in a row that we're the only recipient. That's the overall award. And we're rated best overall quality, best image reputation, best doctors, and second best nurses. This slide shows the number of the underprivileged and underserved that OHSU cares for. The red line on the top is our percentage of Medicare, Medicaid, and non-sponsored discharges in the four-county area. The bottom yellow line is our percent of total discharges. You will see that our share is several times what one would call our proportionate share. Our faculty take a great pride in that we are able to serve this patient population. It is their goal to be in the clinic and serve patients without regard to ability to pay. But what this slide fails to show is also the burden that's placed on the health system by caring for such patients that are referred from out of the four-county area. 40% of our patients are from outside the four-county area, and there this burden is often even disproportionately higher. This is another way of showing the fair share analysis. The red line there, again, is the Medicaid and non-sponsored. And if you will look, there are two hospitals that are notably higher than the yellow average line, and that is OHSU, and you will see the Legacy Emmanuel. And I think it's the community. This is not news to anyone that's outside in the medical community. They know that these are the two hospitals where the most underprivileged and underserved are served, and you will see that the ratio there, or the distance between the yellow and the red lines, is by far greater at OHSU. This is trying to quantify the value of those services that are provided. The projected numbers are listed for 06 and 07 because there are always some adjustments that are made after the close of our fiscal year that are made with Medicaid, so we don't know exactly what those numbers are. So for 06 and 07, those are projected. But as you see, going back for 6-7 years, the value of these services is always significant in the terms of tens of millions of dollars. I wanted to give you a brief overview of our strategic planning process. I think this is appropriate because it's the strategic planning process that will ultimately drive performance evaluation. And I have been in my new role since September 15th, still less than 6 months, but you know, when there's a new president, that's an opportunity to have a new strategic plan. In fact, I'd say it's almost expected. So we've embarked upon that activity. We did recruit some outside assistance from KSA, a consulting group that has experience in other academic health centers, and I wanted to share just ever so briefly some of that with you. This is an inclusive and involving process. We are not done, so this is where we are. We are maybe perhaps halfway through this process. The OHSU Board of Directors has been very involved providing oversight. We have had a retreat with our board. It is driven by the faculty, students, employees, and in fact all stakeholders, and this is one of the reasons that I tried to travel extensively around the state throughout the fall, was to hear what the expectations were of OHSU. We are not just trying to do more better plan. We are looking for ways to be innovative and more efficient, and looking for the ever evasive paradigm shift that will help us better accomplish our mission. in, at the end of the day, what the question that the questions that we're really trying to address is what should OHSU look like in 2020 and what should it stand for? Again, we're not going back to change the mission or the vision. We are quite content with those as they stand. But and just in way of review, here is the vision statement. Oregon Health and Science University is dedicated to improving the health and quality of life for all Oregonians through excellence, innovation, and leadership in healthcare, education, and research. So after much study, 130 interviews, multiple committees, endless meetings, retreat with the board, we tried to come up and in capsule form even condense that more. What do we want OHSU to stand for? If you ask somebody in 2020, what is OHSU? And here's the answer that we came up with. OHSU will make Oregon a national leader in health and science innovation for the purpose of improving the health and well-being of all Oregonians. I think you will see in that statement a very aspirational component, but you will also see in that statement a very direct linkage to the stakeholders here in this state. It is, in my mind, a way of embodying the concept of thinking globally and acting locally. We aspire to greatness, but we want to do so in a way that will have a direct effect here in this state. We think we are well positioned for this long-term success. We want to build on our current foundation. Probably the greatest challenge you see, and this will be a recurrent theme as we do look at the constraint of our operating budget. We will continue to look for new source of funding, and we must remain focused and not just be opportunistic. We must keep our eye on the prize. Since we're only partway through this process, our current budget will be influenced by it, and next year budget will be driven by it. This is the environmental scan. This is just not our own perspective, but a perspective that was formed with the shared input from these experts that have traveled around the country and been at other academic health centers. We noted the rapid growth with some significant strain on our infrastructure. Three new buildings and a tram added in the past year. The future will be markedly shaped by the manner in which we address the workforce shortage. The NIH budget growth has slowed or even stopped. Some may say in a functional sense actually reversed. And despite that, though, OHSU this year was one of only 12 institutions in the country to receive one of the Clinical and Translational Science Awards. This is a $55 million award, and we were able to do that for, among other reasons, our ability to partner with Kaiser. This is a slide that condenses several of the missions and shows our marked growth across all of them. The growth in the students over the past two decades, the growth in the patients we served, and the phenomenal growth in the amount of research funding. The three buildings that have built are now operational. There is still some shelled space, but the non-shelled space is now operational. Those buildings were brought online, on budget, on time. I'm happy to say that the tram is working very efficiently, and it really has connected two parcels of land and made them one campus. This was the key element in the development of the south waterfront. The tram ridership is much greater than people even anticipated. Just a faculty member came up to me the other day and said, "Joe, you know, it's truly amazing that the way to bring us together was actually to spread us apart and then make us meet out of the tram landing." It's serving as a tremendous marshaling area. I can't tell you how many people have talked to me about things they've shared programs while they've ridden back and forth on the tram. The visits to the Center for Health and Healing, which is at the base of the tram, are ramping up at a rate that's greater than anticipated. This has been a marked boon to public transportation throughout Portland. I think it's provided a very favorable experience, and it's resulted in a marked increase in the streetcar ridership that comes to and from it. And I have people all the time telling me now that instead of taking their car, they're going to take the tram and go to the streetcar, ride their bike. So it's I think the impact has been greater. larger than we ever imagined. A couple slides will follow now that really show the overlying theme of the crisis of the workforce. This slide shows the marked aging of our population, and this slide shows, without going into all the details, how we're much greater utilizers of health care as we age. You will see many other slides over the next several days that pertain to this. This shows, again, how many more outpatient visits we utilize as we age. And finally, we also have a grain of the healthcare workforce. It's not just a grain of our population. Our workforce is grained at the same time. And just as some of us retire, we're looking around and wonder who's going to care for us at the time of retirement. This is an interesting slide, and it shows that this is nationwide, the number of first-year medical students per 100,000 of the population, and shows how that has markedly declined over the past two decades and is expected to continue to decline. And of great concern to me is the fact that in Oregon we only train half the number of students per capita compared to the rest of the country. The voters now believe...
Excuse me, Dr. Robertson. Representative Jensen.
Yes.
Just a quick comment, if you have any, on the reason for the decline in physicians.
The reason is, since about 1980, while this is true for almost all of the health professions, let me just use medicine as an example. Since roughly 1980, the number of medical students has been flat. We have not increased the number of students despite a population that has grown more rapidly than anticipated and a population that today has aged. This is a slide for dentistry, and the slide, I think all of us know, the dramatic shortage in nursing, and this is showing that the spread between demand and supply is continuing to widen despite the marked efforts that we've made to address it. It's a much broader issue, though, than just health care. This is actually true in all of the health and engineering fields. Very great concern to OHSU, because we look at the OGI as an example of the type of biomedical engineering and other expertise that we think we will need to deliver the cures in the future, and we are concerned that the workforce will not be there to provide it. These are the revenue challenges we face. Clinical reimbursement is obviously under pressure. There's a limited ability for us to grow our tuition revenue. The NIH budget, as we've mentioned, is flat. And the Oregon Opportunity Funds have been expended, and we are very busy. In fact, that's what I spend a significant amount of my time doing, is trying to raise philanthropic dollars. But the donors often choose the purpose for which they wish those dollars to be expended, and we often don't control them. The expectation of value will be from consumers, payers, and NIH, so there is considerable direction as to where our efforts will be expended. It is going to be important for us to differentiate ourselves. We will be all about developing new models. We must focus our resources, and of course, of key importance is the recruitment and retention of our best faculty. And that is, as this workforce shortage becomes greater, there's going to be a greater and greater strain across the country on the faculty. And our success in some ways makes us more vulnerable. It's like having a championship team, and suddenly you have people that are free agents, and others are putting a target on them and wishing very much to recruit them away. I want to make sure that I leave plenty of time for Leslie. I'm going to condense this. Our motto here is, by 2020, OHSU will make Oregon a national leader in health and science innovation for the purpose of improving the health and well-being of all Oregonians. And there was a lot of things that we must do, but let's go right to the five-year goals. We want to align our enterprises to support sustainable innovation in healthcare. care, develop a faculty that will collaborate to drive excellence and innovation, build our financial wherewithal, join others in developing policy solutions that improve access to high-quality health care for all, especially Oregonians, meet the workforce need, and be a great organization, diverse in people and ideas. If you really want to summarize what I just said, you will understand that OHSU and our aspiration for greatness is going to do it through innovation and partnership in a way that has a direct effect here on Oregonians. Diversity is one of our core values. As besides our strategic plan, if we talk about values, those that come up frequently are quality, transparency, service excellence, and diversity. I think diversity is often a challenge here in Oregon, but it is absolutely essential for us. If we're going to train people to treat a diverse population, we must recruit a diverse population of students and have a diverse faculty population. It is also absolutely imperative if we are going to maintain a competitive advantage. You're going to have a diverse workforce if you want to have the best workforce and the most creative workforce. We will make the investment to do so. You hear OHSU described as where healing, teaching, and discovery come together. I think in the 20th century, people thought about that in a geographic sense. It was those functions that happened to be co-located up on Markham Hill. We now see the campus much broader than that, and when we hear where healing, teaching, and discovery come together, we would like for people to think of it as this Venn diagram rather than the geographics. That we want to do all three. We want to do them well. We want to do them concurrently. We want to be experts working at that interface, because it's often at the interface where the great discoveries will occur. And this is where we think we can distinguish ourselves as a university. We, being in Oregon or in Portland, we will never be the largest academic health center, but we think we can be at the best at working at this interface of these missions. And here is this shown in another way, the six major goals that I just mentioned to you. We will align so that they cross all of the missions. So at the end of the day, in 2020, we would like people to say not only the slogan that we always hear or commonly hear, Oregon, things are different here, but because of OHSU, things are better here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson.
Any other questions?
Senator Deck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go to Leslie's, but I'll forget if I don't ask it now. So on slide, and I think it's starting at about slide 40, and it's 41, 42, 43. It's basically the health professional shortage question. And I particularly looked at dentists and doctors. And
yes,
the thought is that far from being a problem for Oregon, it's actually an opportunity, given that we've been able to attract this type of person, and if there's a growing need in the West, folks look to institutions like OHSU, and then to me it's just a question of how do we capitalize on that opportunity, because of the unique situation I would think OHSU finds itself in as a magnet for these type of individuals, and then their proclivity to actually stay here and practice here once they go to OHSU.
No, I absolutely couldn't agree more. We do not have a problem attracting applicants, but it is funding the educational process. For instance, in medical school, and even though the model isn't complete, but the expense is probably somewhere between $85,000 and $100,000 per student on the capitation model, we can't push the tuition that high. So the challenge for us is to create a sound financial model that will allow us to continue to increase the enrollment.
So, Mr. Chair, the only thought would be, well, because of the need, you would think it's going to be so great. Is that an opportunity? And maybe that's something your board and y'all have discussed. This is a real opportunity for, in terms of tuition, flexibility, other areas where we can just draw more resources because of the two lines are going in the wrong direction and where we find ourselves.
Well, it is, and I'm trying not to jump ahead into something that you're going to hear about, but I just can't resist myself. I'm sorry.
Go for it.
This is one of the, as As you probably know, just over two weeks ago, we received a $40 million anonymous gift toward building a new medical school. Okay, that will not construct a new medical school. That will ensure that we can at least build one building that will help us increase the size of the class. The other thing that's important about that is that that will be the catalyst for developing a new campus that will hopefully allow us to increase the number of students in each of the schools and build it in an interdisciplinary manner that you will hear a lot more about in the coming days. We think that is indeed an incredible opportunity. It's an opportunity that really has never occurred in the U.S. because most academic health centers are in urban areas, and you don't get 20 new acres of land in an urban area, and it hasn't happened when there's a real driver to increase the workforce, and nobody's been able to do it in an interdisciplinary manner, but yet people are expected to work together when they graduate. So we think it is an opportunity. This is one of the reasons that you kept hearing the word innovation, is we want to look at our educational model and not just have it be better and bigger, but have it be different.
Chairman Blasio and members of the committee, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU, and it's my task to cover several things today that are part of your process. So I thought I might take just a minute to kind of introduce you to the notebook, this heavy tome that's in front of you, the legislative notebook, and also to explain what's in the manila folder that's sitting at your desk. There are a couple of late-breaking addenda that you can insert in the notebook, and so I thought I'd tell you what is there. There's a table of contents on the top, and under tab 2 are the slides that we've begun to share with you. The very first item in this manila folder looks like this, are in fact some additional slides, and they should be inserted, and it tells you there under part 2, which is where I began right now, and in that section at the very end, page 49, you can just kind of insert it at the end. It's just some additional data that pertains, in fact, in part to the question that was just asked, but to a variety of other things. So if you just replace that questions or suggestions on page 49 with these additional pages, we'll come to them a little bit later on. And then, give you a minute there. The next additional item are in the policy option package and the performance measures that pertain to those. And so this goes under tab 9 in the book. So if you go all the way to the back to tab 9, you can insert. You will find under tab 9 a summary page, the first page, which shows the various policy option packages that were requested in the governor's process. And immediately after that, the first 5 pages would be replaced by these. Or you can just stick them on top. But these first 5 pages that we've given a little orange tab go right after that first page in tab 9. And they're basically updates on the projections in nursing, as you'll see when we come to those. On graduation of nurses and the new policy option packages. And finally, the last page, and I'm sorry for the housekeeping here, is in the research section, which is back in tab 2 in the slides after my section and in the material that you'll be hearing tomorrow from Dr. Borsa on research. And as it says here under part 3, in that tab 2, which is right after my section that you just inserted, there's a yellow leaflet, and it's part 3 right after that. And if you insert this behind, right where the page number indicates, it's page 13, it's a new page 13. So it simply replaces page 13 in part 3. I apologize for the confusion that may have caused. There's a couple of new things that have occurred in the last week we couldn't resist sharing with you. Are there any questions in that material? What what I am going to do now is simply go through a couple of things. One will be to tell you a little bit about the performance measures we use, and also to talk about how the state dollars are utilized and leveraged at OHSU, and which aspects of our performance measures depend upon those state dollars. This will very directly tell you what performance measures apply to the policy option packages we are requesting. And fortunately, in our case, it's actually fairly simple. Virtually all of the requests are addressed to workforce shortages, and virtually all the measures measure whether we've produced some solutions to those workforce crises in the manner, in the form of providers. The state funding, and this is on slide 59 now in this section, so just continuing on right after Dr. Robertson, and yours will look a little different just because of the numbering, but this slide should look exactly the same. Most of the money that the state provides is in the educational mission, in the schools. There is a little bit of money, and you saw that in Mr. Bender's report, in the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. And there's also a fair bit, there's support in the Poison Center. And the Poison Center, which serves the state and several surrounding states, is also funded in part by federal grants, but the state does help that. And the slide that looks like this might be the most helpful way to find it in the book, because it's unique. It's about the third page in part two.
It's on page four, and the bottom one is labeled number eight. The next slide.
Thank you. Everyone see where we are in the notebook. This is a breakout of the revenue sources at OHSU that you saw in a single pie chart when Dr. Robertson shows it. Red refers to the clinical reimbursement, revenue from Blue Cross, from Medicaid, from other sources of clinical revenue. Yellow refers to research grants, and green is the state, and blue is the tuition sources of revenue. And I think what you can see here, without having to go through each and every circle, is that the clinical activities, the patient care, are predominantly supported by clinical revenue. The research activities in the research institutes are almost entirely supported by research grants, the yellow in this diagram. The schools, however, are much more complicated. The schools are supported in part by the state, in part by tuition, in part by some clinical revenue, and also they conduct research, and so they're supported partly by yellow in this diagram, by research grants. And then outreach activities in are generally public mission activities, and they're generally supported by some combination of the state, but we leverage the state and or federal government, but we try and leverage those resources wherever possible, and you'll hear an example of that in the Office of Rural Health and the AHEC programs later on. Another way to look at the expenditures of OHSU is by mission. And instead of dividing it out by unit, the schools, the hospital, and so forth, if instead you look at the mission, the education, clinical care, or research, and then ask how are those missions supported, you get a little bit different picture. And you can see that the red diagram, the hospitals, are virtually 100% supported by clinical sources of revenue and research, in fact, is supported by research. But education is more complicated. The education mission at OHSU is funded, if you aggregate all the schools, roughly a third by the state appropriation, a third by tuition revenue, and a third by essentially anything else we can cobble together. And those things are scholarships, federal training grants, and clinical revenue, which is transferred to help subsidize those. So it's a bit of a scramble to fill that gap sometimes, but the state essentially covers about a third. Now, that varies from school to school, depending on the ability of the school to bring in other resources. And this is what I just explained. You've seen the state support graph. This is another version of the same kind of thing that Mr. Bender showed you. We went back to 91-93, so it's just a longer curve, but it's essentially the same idea. If you correct for inflation and look at real purchasing power, you see a pretty broad gap between today and what was funded in 91. And we'll come back to Senator Morse's question kind of indirectly in a slightly different way of looking at it to get at the funding per student. And how we've looked at it. Today, we have about 3,500 learners at OHSU. There's approximately 1,000 beyond degree-seeking students who are in training of one sort or another, usually postdoctoral training, residents in the medical school, and postdoctoral fellows in the research setting, trainees. They can, and this does not include continuing education, which are in the tens of thousands. But these are students who are essentially enrolled in a training program at OHSU. This is my attempt to show you the answer to Senator Morse's question. If you look at the state appropriation and then compare it in the yellow, that very tall yellow bar, to what the inflationary amount would have been had you corrected the 91-93 appropriation according to the Consumer Price Index, you can see the difference there in 05-07 between the $73 million for the biennium and what it would have been had it just been flat and corrected for inflation. And in spite of that gap, the blue line gives you the student enrollment over that same period of time. So in spite of a decrease in funding, we found ways to increase the capacity of training. Now, we've taken OGI, the Oregon Graduate Institute, out of these figures because there is no state support in there, so we thought that would be cheap. It would be more dramatic, but it wouldn't really be an apples-to-apples comparison. So this is School of Medicine, Nursing, and Dentistry that are in here. And so we've really scrambled to find ways to train more students. A lot of this growth is actually in other areas that you might not know. You heard Dr. Robertson talk about no graduate school. The graduate school is embedded in the other schools. The School of Medicine has increased tremendously the number of graduate students it trains. Those could be public health individuals. They can be doctoral students in biotechnology areas and biomedical research areas. So there's a lot of growth around the research and around the healthcare growth. But most of those are unfunded or underfunded and have been funded by this combination of sources I've already discussed. I have in here, and I'm not going to take the time to go through, but would be happy to discuss with anyone who's interested, some what we call capitation analysis. And what we do in these, and we presented this in some detail to another committee last week, is we have gone through our entire educational mission, and because of the way we do accounting, we actually record our expenditures according to mission. So whether or not a faculty is spending a portion of their time on the educational mission, the research mission, or the clinical care mission is noted in the way the data is captured and the way our fiscals are kept. So we can go into that data and pull out how much faculty time was expended on education and, in fact, on educating which cohort of students. And so we can also allocate all the space because we have a very detailed space inventory as to whether it's education or research or clinical and so on across the list of expenditures. And when we look at the total cost per student and then we look at how do we pay for that, what are the resources, we developed this, this data and we have it for all three schools. And I'll just show you this one, and we can touch on the others, or as I say, I can respond to any questions you might have. A baccalaureate nurse, undergraduate nurse, nursing student, costs about $20,000 a year to educate. Of that, if you consider, and of course it depends on how you think about the state dollars being allocated, but if you consider all the dollars that go to the School of Nursing being allocated across all the students that are resident students, Oregon residents, in proportion to the cost of their educational program, we would have $10,000 per student from the state contributed to the education of that individual. There are other kinds of things that come in support of that. Tuition is another. And there's a gap. And the line across the bottom is the gap we have to fill. In nursing, it's not quite as large as in the other schools because the state percent in the School of Nursing is higher. And we allocate it that way because they have less of an ability to bring in clinical revenue, for example, than the medical school does. And we have similar, and the three cohorts of students across the top represent undergraduate students who become RNs. The middle cohort, nurse practitioner and clinical nurse specialist, are people who become advanced practitioners. And the final column are the academic programs. Those typically become teachers in other programs or researchers. Now, we also have, there are other ways of looking at this data, and I won't belabor that in this presentation in terms of how you spread it, but I will point out that in dentistry, the average cost to train a dental student is $62,000 a year, and if you look in the case of medicine, it's almost $90,000 for a medical student. There are other cohorts, however, in the medical school that you should be aware of, including all the graduate students, and then a variety of master's students who are in things like the MPH program and informatics, which is the study of the information and the science around decision-making in medicine. And those students aren't as expensive. They spend more time in the classroom and more time on computers. It's a little different kind of teaching than the one-on-one clinical skill teaching that goes on in the direct healthcare professions. So this gives you a little bit of a glimpse of the kinds of things that that your dollars really help support. But if you look at the bottom line of this curve, it shows the cumulative university support that is not provided by one of these other revenue streams and must be found somewhere, and typically that clinical bottom line is what provides that resource. Now, I'm not going to go through these one by one, but we have developed over the course of the last several biennia a set of performance measures in collaboration with the legislature and Mr. Bender, really beginning back in 96, right after the public corporation was formed. And for the first several biennia, the performance measures were included in the legislative report. And we provide that every session and in the form of this booklet that's in your cover. And that gives a series of graphs and data that show the kinds of things that we have been tracking and sharing with you every year, actually, but in this book form every other year. In 2005, in the last session, we were asked to develop a set of performance measures more along the lines of the ones that the other agencies have been developing. They were much the same as these, but they also included setting targets and then reporting in the state forms. And so much of the material that you see in tab 3 are the result of that direction. We were directed to develop the performance measures, which were listed in our budget bill in 2005, and bring them back to the JLAC, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, in July of 2006, which we did. And in that, under that tab, is a set of a document that we brought to the JLAC in July. In that session, educational agencies that reported were directed to actually reduce the number of performance measures and focus on ones that were not just output but were real outcomes. And so out of that JLAC committee came a recommendation that 23 be retained as key performance measures and that the remainder continue to be tracked as internal data. And so there follows in your book of slides a large number of slides that have those key performance measures in the same format that the state requires, and you've probably seen from other agencies. And they go through a number of additional measures that that track things like graduation rates and graduation numbers and a variety of metrics that by which we measure ourselves. In August and September, when the budgets were submitted to the governor, we took the recommendations from JLAC and submitted them and their targets. And that document is also in here. And then now we will share them with you and bring back to you a couple of requests by way of requested revisions, but they're fairly minor that I'll share with you in just a minute. So I will not go through each one of these, but I did want to give you just a real high-level framework in which you could think about them, and then we can talk about any of them that you think we should discuss further. You'll be hearing about individual ones in the context of the programs over the next couple of days as the program presentations proceed. But we basically have divided these key performance measures in terms of your thinking and ours into the mission areas. So the panel on the left of this graph shows the key performance measures that relate to the educational mission. We look at in-state access, which was a specific request from the last legislature. What that means is the percent of admitted students that are residents of Oregon. And so we look at that as one metric. We look at what we consider a real outcome here, the degrees awarded in each area. And that's, in fact, the main performance measure that we believe should be used to track our policy option package requests. And you'll see that. We also look at competence of the people we train. Typically that's measured, it's a hard thing to measure, but typically it's measured by the first time pass rate on the various licensure exams. We're fortunate compared to higher ed in that we have licensure exams, so we have some quantitative data about most of our graduates. And then finally we try and track pipeline programs. Again, a difficult thing to do, but you can do it in a variety of ways. You can track the number of people you touch, however you touch them, whether you enroll them in a program, but the ultimate measure takes 20 years, because the ultimate measure is, do they go on in a health and science field? Do they ultimately become a healthcare provider? And we're beginning to see those students matriculate. We've been tracking them for quite a while, but that's another sort of measure. In the research mission group, there are a number of measures that we track internally. The one key performance measure that remained that was recommended by the JLAC had to do with the portion of the NIH budget which we capture, and that's that research key performance measure number 13. In the clinical arena, there are a number of things that one can measure that track volume, basically, or the kinds of things you do within that volume. But if what you really want to track is quality of the care you provide, there are a number of very specific measures. One is just patient satisfaction based on patient surveys, and there are national surveys that are conducted outside of OHSU, and we have proposed that those be one measure of the quality, the patient satisfaction. Another, which is by some perhaps viewed as a bit severe, but it's an incredibly important one, is the mortality rate. And that is how, corrected for the severity of the diagnoses that enter your system, what's the outcome relative to what you would expect that outcome to be on a national basis. And you see in the key performance measures that OHSU tracks incredibly well in that measure, a very important performance measure. The Poison Center and CDRC have a similar issue, actually, around key performance measures, and I'll come to that in just a minute, and that is that they have always and will continue to track volume, the number of people who call, the number of patients who visit, the number of services delivered, the number of times a patient family has to return to complete their services, but that doesn't tell you about the quality of the service, and so we have a proposal to begin to address that. One of the measures for the Poison Center is, does the caller end up going to an emergency room? And that's one sort of measure about whether you solved the problem over the phone or they ended up in the emergency room. Now, let me just skip here ahead, because rather than drag you through each of these, which I don't want to do, we can come back to them, but there's a lot of them. And I want to get to the end and then come back on specific program areas. So I'm going to ask you to go down past where the performance measures are tracked internally, and the graphs all look like this, to the requested revisions slide. And I'll find it in your book here.
I see it on R, it looks like it's 37.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Page 37 in this part 2 gives you a little bit something that you won't hear specifically from others, but a couple of things that we believe should be changed to be more meaningful for you and for us. And we've been working with Mr. Bender on the first two. And one is the definition of the bottom line. One of the key performance measures was the bottom line. Now, that sounds like a pretty straightforward measure, and it is. But accounting rules dictate that our bottom line is, in fact, a consolidated measure combined with our foundation. And when you combine it with the foundation, it takes into account the net income of the foundation. Some of that is affected by the market influence on their endowments and holdings, which then impact their net income statement. That doesn't say very much about our operation or our operational performance. It says something about the value of their holdings, and that's useful information. All of that information is submitted each year as part of our audited financials, but we believe that our operating net income is really the best measure of our performance against our budget. And so we would request that that be changed. Now, let me show you a couple of graphs that illustrate that a little bit. If you look at our income statements, and they're in the very back of this, they really include the two portions of the institution, the university and the hospital. If you look at the net income of the university, it is negative most years, because it's the whole mission is not funded by the complete set of revenues that are associated with the university. If you look at the hospital, it's positive, but the way things are consolidated, they are consolidated with the foundation on the university side. Now, if you look at this consolidated, it shows a net income where there, in fact, is no cash. There is not net income in 2006, but the market did better in 2006, and so the foundation net income looks better because of the adjustments they make based on their holdings. So I think this, if you just go back and forth between those two pages, you'll see that it's kind of a distortion of our net income and the amount of cash we actually have. It doesn't even reflect cash they have, actually, that is can be liberated. It has to do with the value of their holdings. If you look at the university the excluding the foundation and including the foundation, you can see that the story isn't very different, but there really is a distortion of the net operating income. So we believe, and the way our board judges us, is how we are managing to our net operating income. That may be confusing, but maybe I should pause and see if there are questions about that.
Senator Morton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you use fund accounting or real accounting?
We don't use fund accounting, in fact, anymore. So it's GASB or FASB.
Patrick is in the audience. Which is it?
GASB. So it isn't exactly fund accounting. These are now the government standards.
The right way to account.
That's what I'm told. Yes. All right. I want to say just in the last couple of minutes a little bit about the policy option packages. You will hear about these in detail in the coming presentations, but I want to tell you just a little bit about them and show you one additional slide. If you look at our workforce initiatives, and you'll be hearing about these in detail, but we are asking for additional resources to expand the capacity to train physicians, nurses, and dentists. That's where we think there's the most immediate need. You've been hearing about the nursing shortage for a couple of biennia from us, but this is the first time we've really come to you with a specific request in medicine and dentistry. And I'm not going to go through the case for it. I think you've heard a little bit of it. You're going to hear more of it. But what I do want to do is get to the end of this section and show you the bottom line here. These are the pages that I just asked you to insert. So they're right at the end of this section. And what we've done here is take from a performance measure point of view, what are we going to do If you fund the requested policy option packages, in this case, in undergraduate nursing. So in undergraduate nursing, we have four requests. The baseline at the bottom, the blue line, is our current production of undergraduate nurses as we predict going forward. The reason there's 311 at the 2005, so you know what that is, there was a year, a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago, when we accepted an entire additional class mid-year in December in order to graduate an extra cohort. We weren't funded to do that. In fact, it was the school came to me with this request, very unusual request, with no additional resources. They wanted to take an extra class, and they had two reasons they wanted to do that. One was that they had a superb applicant pool, just an incredible applicant pool, and they didn't want to waste that applicant pool. The second is they knew we were going to open additional hospital beds. There were two other facilities growing in the metro area, and that about the time they were going to hit the market is when this cohort would graduate, and it would at least ease some of the pressure from that additional demand, which is exactly what happened. They graduated, they just graduated, and that's that blip up. And if the curve went back, you would see that it went up and then came down. So that's an additional class. But the four option packages that we have, three are in the undergraduate arena, and the orange curve represents the what we call the OCNE program. And you'll be hearing more about that tomorrow, but it's basically an articulation with community colleges on community college campuses that allows students to complete a baccalaureate. The blue is the expanded base on the existing campuses. These are additive now, and if you were going to take any one of them alone, you would add it to the blue line, not on top of one another. But this is if each were funded in order. And the green line is an additional cohort of approximately 27 to 30 students on the Monmouth campus, analogous to the cohorts now on the Ashland, Klamath Falls, and LeGrand campuses of OUS. So these are the graduation predictions. And the reason we created this graph, which is not in the state form, is that the state forms only go out to 2009. And they don't graduate that soon. So we had to go out much further than that so you could see these cohorts go through their curriculum. And the last slide I'll show you, last two. One is the fourth policy option package in nursing is for graduate nurses. The turquoise would be if the policy option package were funded. And that represents teachers who could teach in the community colleges, which is a huge rate limiting factor right now, is the teaching capacity. And finally, I'll leave you with the MD policy option package, which is the two packages that are before you are reflected here in red and green. The blue, or bottom line, again, is an additional cohort we took. That's why it's blipping up, and then would drop back down if there's no additional funding, because we cannot sustain 120, a class size of 120 in medicine. We're funded at about 90, frankly, and we've eked up as many as we can. This year we took a huge leap of faith and went to 120. We will obviously see those students through to graduation, but we cannot sustain that class size unless that one package is funded. And as you'll hear, that's a one-time ask, the one biennium ask, in that by the second biennium for that specific policy option package, there would be no request for dollars because the tuition revenue from all four classes at that size would be sufficient to carry it. That final curve, the green, represents the regionalization. You'll be hearing this theme across all our schools, but in medicine in particular, this would put cohorts of medical students on the ground in Eugene and in Corvallis for their first year, and then again in clinical rotations around the state in their third and fourth. They would come back to Portland in their second. So this is the expansion that we would be seeking in leveraging our existing base with the community health practices and the U of O and OSU as partners in this endeavor. And I think I better stop there since I think we're out of time, but I'm happy to take questions, of course.
So just for clarification, so you had 108 medical students, but you're saying you kind of ramped it up to 120, and so that's
correct.
Okay.
We started at 90, and then we're at 96 for quite a few years, and then the last couple we've added four per year to get to 108, and then this year we took 120, and it looks like he's
yeah, I mean, This is, I'm partly to blame for this, so I think it's only fair that I answer, because this happened when I was actually dean of the medical school, and this was literally done on the leap of proverbial good faith. I mean, we saw what the economic cycle was, and we saw that the workforce shortage was upon us, and so we admitted extra students knowing we couldn't sustain it for the long term, and in fact, the pledge I made to the faculty was that we will not sustain this, but if we can't be funded now, we can't wait till later. Let's try and do the right thing now, and then if the economic situation in the state is such that it improves and we can be funded, then at least we had a head start. So that's how it came about.
Thank you very much. Senator Morse?
Dr. Halleck, if we could go back to what those series of pages, our pages, 7, 8, and 9, and if you could elaborate on what the university contribution was, what the student capitation program costs and contributions for students. Explain more, for example, School of Dentistry, university contribution for a resident is $3,800, a non-resident is about $22,000. What are you telling us?
I'm glad you asked that question. Let me get to the right page here.
Here's 5, 6, 4, 5.
Okay, are you on, is it nursing? What medicine?
Dentistry.
Dentistry line.
Actually.
No, we can do it with any of them. Because they're all done the same.
There you go.
When we do the capitation analysis, we look at the total cost of the students enrolled in that program, be they residents or non-residents, because when we teach them, they're all in this pool together. When we try and understand what's supporting them, the cost is the same, regardless of how we allocate the state dollars on a graph, the total cost doesn't change. So what I gave you are two, we actually have 10 different ones for each school, all look exactly the same except for that state contribution line. And the rest is the same because it costs the same, and the net contribution in the university is the same. But if you think about the program and how we allocate state dollars, of course, they're all in the same program, but the way you could think about those state dollars as only supporting resident students, or you could think about them as supporting the same for all students. And if you do it that way, and that isn't how you think of it generally, but if you think about how they're taught, they're sort of taught that way. So this way, they're all in the same pool. They all attend the same lectures, get the same education. The difference is that they pay more tuition if they're a non-resident. And so the university has to contribute more to the resident. In other words, the resident pays less tuition, and so there's a gap. In the medical school, it's about $10,000 difference between resident and non-resident tuition. So the university, for the number of residents it takes, has to come up with that. If you prefer to think about it as money only going to the education of residents, which is understandable, then you end up with a slightly different picture. The bottom line's the same if you add across. It's just a question of how you think about those dollars. If you look at it as a whole, we can take as many residents as you support us to take. It's a public policy decision, really. And so some years you see a shift down in the percent residents when we have received cuts. In other years, it'll increase. In medicine, for example, we were able to actually increase the percent residents in this last year through a combination of things, some scholarships actually, as well as just operating very efficiently. So it varies in terms of what we can afford to do in resident education. Now, I would add, in nursing, the picture is a little different in that most students are residents. So there, if you look, if you go back a couple of slides and you look at the nursing, you can see that in the undergraduate case, 516 students were residents and 39 were non-residents. So we don't take very many non-residents there. And the tuition there has been kept much lower than it is in medicine and dentistry. It's still higher than an OUS undergrad, an average undergrad, but it's considerably lower than the other two. And that's, we've really worked at keeping that as low as we possibly could. Their entry-level salaries are lower, in fact, than physicians and dentists, although they're
they're reasonable, certainly, but so we've tried to keep the debt load down as much as we could. Did that address your question, or?
Yes, it did.
We need to adjourn. I can do this offline. Yeah, I'm fine.
Especially after the last 2 days where I've kept people 8 hours. So, and usually I'm trying to, when I have doctors, I want them to stay longer. But so you can do it. Anyway, Dr. Robertson, Dr. Halleck, thank you very much. More to come tomorrow, and I'm going to adjourn today's meeting.